Tonight, I would like to invite us to focus on the five spiritual faculties. They are sometimes called the five controlling faculties. Sometimes they're just referred to as the five faculties. And very confusing, they're the very same five things that make up the five powers. And this can cause a lot of confusion in the teachings. And one way to think of this, just one way to think of that, is that as we become more skillful with the five faculties of mind, we develop the five powers based on being more skillful with those faculties. So that's one way to think about that. Not the only way. And they can also be referred to as the five virtues sometimes. And I think of them as five skillful means for use in our practice. They're particularly useful on retreats, but they're very useful on daily life too. And I, when I'm teaching teachers-to-be how to assess a yogi on a retreat, a residential retreat, when they come in for an interview, we don't call them that anymore, we call them practice meetings. When they come in for a practice meeting, that to use one way, one tool for hearing, like seeing, you know, there's different ways of seeing, different ways of hearing, is to hear with what they're saying about how they are relating to their practice in regards to the five spiritual faculties, without ever necessarily mentioning it to the yogi. But it's a very interesting way, and you can take these, I'll talk about the balancing of these faculties tonight, and you can take that into your next retreat, or in your home practice, when you're doing a home practice. I mentioned the upcoming day-long, very good to be aware of this in a day-long situation, about how you're working with each of these five. And I will take you through what each is, and then come back and do more detailed, and then go back again and do some balancing around this. This is how the Buddha described it in the Samyutta Nikaya, and it's called the Indriya Samyutta. This is coming out of the Vedic tradition of this word Indra, who was the one of the gods that sort of governed this realm. And so it's said this way: there are these five faculties, monks: the faculty of faith, the faculty of vigor, the faculty of mindfulness, the faculty of concentration, the faculty of wisdom. Five faculties, repeating: the faculty of faith, the faculty of vigor or energy, virya, that we often refer to it. Faith is sadhana, so the faculty of faith and the faculty of vigor. And if you were having a teeter-totter or seesaw, you can think of those two sitting on the same side of the seesaw, the faith and then the energy. And then mindfulness is the third that's in the middle. And then on the other side is concentration and wisdom. So this is the balancing, and it's mindfulness. It sits that right there in the middle between those other two. Another analogy that the Buddha used at one point is he said, it's mindfulness is like the lead horse of a five-horse carriage. There's two pairs of horses, and the mindfulness is the lead horse that's pulling it all forward, that keeps everything in balance. I like this analogy very much because you cannot have a fast horse that's faster than the other horses when you're working together as five horses. It's just not possible, right? So that sense, and the lead horse is very important. The same with I used to have a friend who raced dog sledding in Alaska. Same thing. That you can't, you're only as good as the one that is the weakest in that sense. So that you have to have some sort of balance there. These are the five faculties, monks: the faculty of faith, the faculty of vigor, the faculty of mindfulness, the faculty of concentration, and the faculty of wisdom. So, concentration, wisdom over here, faith and energy over here, mindfulness right there in the center. Connecting down, grounding it all. Grounding it all. Grounding it where? Grounding it in the present moment. Remembering, mindfulness has this remembering quality that's coming out of Smriti. So remembering what? Remembering the intention to practice with these faculties. Remembering our intention to practice. I talk about the importance of intentional mindfulness all the time, and just like with the importance of compassionate mindfulness. Where can the faculty of faith be seen at its best? In the four characteristic qualities of a stream winner. Those qualities are a belief in or faith in the Buddha Dhamma Sangha and in sila, in morality. Not causing harm, best way to state that. So where can the faculty of faith be seen at its best? In the four characteristics. Faith in the Buddha, faith in the Dhamma, faith in the Sangha. Not believing like you'd believe in a god. Not like that, but faith in that this is a reliable means to liberation. So where can this faculty of faith be seen at its best? In the four characteristic qualities of a stream winner. So, or sometimes called stream enterer, sotipanna. Where can the faculty of vigor be seen at its best? In the four right efforts. Those four right efforts are part of the Eightfold Path. Of these four right efforts. The right efforts are when you're in a place that's causing harm or not a wholesome place to be or not employing a skillful means, you move your mind away from that. If you see your mind going towards the unwholesome, you avert the mind. If you see the mind going towards something that's wholesome, you encourage it. If you see that your mind is in a wholesome place using skillful means, you stay there. You encourage it to stay there. Those are the four right efforts. Where can the faculty of mindfulness be seen? In the four foundations of mindfulness. Mindfulness of the body. Mindfulness of the feeling tone, that is the pleasant and unpleasant and neither pleasant nor unpleasant tone of each moment. And then mindfulness of our mind states and emotions, the third foundation of mindfulness. And then the fourth, the mindfulness of the Dhamma in all of these moments. The mindfulness of the Dhamma ends with understanding the Four Noble Truths. So that's interesting how these all tie together. But right before that, the penultimate of the fourth foundation is the seven awakening factors, which most of you that have been here regularly have heard me teach at one time or another, because I personally more lean to teaching the seven awakening factors. I don't mean to overwhelm those of you who are new with all these lists and all this stuff, so just let it run through. It's like a breeze, you know, you don't hold on to a breeze. So because those of you with more experience, the awakening factors I find are like more, I can organize better an actual practice around the awakening factors than the five faculties work better for assessment for me, whereas orienting the practice itself, the awakening factors work better for me. I'm not saying that would be true for you. And then where can the faculty of concentration be seen at its best? In the four meditative absorption. These are these absorption states called jhanas, and 1 through 4. We could also understand it in relation to what's called neighborhood concentration, or even temporary concentration, moment-to-moment concentration, it's called. Where can the faculty of wisdom be seen? In the Four Noble Truths. So the realization, not the conceptual understanding, but the direct felt sense, like I ask you to feel the body directly, not your view and opinion about your body experience, but to feel it directly in the meditation. This is what is meant by the realization of the Four Noble Truths. It's not an intellectual understanding. It's like a aha, oh, I get it. It's like you feel it down to your toes. You know, it's just like, whew, you get the Four Noble Truths, the truth of dukkha, the truth of the cause of dukkha, the cessation of dukkha, and the path that leads to the cessation of dukkha. So these five faculties tie in to all the Buddha's key teachings. And it can be overwhelming at the beginning because we can be so, there's just too many lists, there's too many different things, and it's just too confusing. But that's trying to grab hold of it. If you just receive it in this moment, whatever you're receiving in this moment, then gradually the whole reveals itself by just staying present for an individual piece of the teaching. You don't have to grasp all the teachings. I was very leery of this in my own practice, so I was very resistant to reading any kind of Dhamma material for a number of years because I did not want to get in my head. I'd spent plenty of time in my head already. So I was very leery of getting an intellectual understanding of the Buddha's teachings and not this direct experience. So I really would deliberately not try to hold on. I mean, I really knew what I was doing and why. And I'd sit on the three-month retreat, or it's the first 6 weeks of the three-month retreat, whatever I was doing that particular year, and not try to get the big picture, but to get what was being offered in this little piece of the Dharma talk. And now here's a little later. There's another little piece. I just wanted to understand this moment's teaching. And then out of that, for me at least, grew a larger understanding as whatever form it is and however poor it is. But nonetheless, that's how it came about. So these are these five spiritual faculties. Faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. So just say them to yourself for a moment. And then the next step would be you would take one of them and say, well, so what does faith mean to me? Or what does energy mean to me? How do I understand it right now? Or mindfulness? Or concentration? Or wisdom? So you start to make it your Dhamma. Just what does it mean right now? You're not thinking you understand everything about it. You don't have to do that. But right now, what does that mean? I when I hear this word, of wisdom, what does it mean to me? At different times it may mean different things, but then that's part of what you discover. So that it's all along you're referencing back to your own experience, not trying to just accept somebody else's definition, although really interested in other people's definition. That's a little clue about how to practice with these things. Faith is the seed needed for spiritual life to grow. If there's not some degree of faith, then it just never gets started. Or you may get started, but at the first time that there's difficulty that you don't understand, or your body's hurting, or you're sleepy, you go, oh, I can't do this, or it doesn't work for me. Or you practice some mindfulness for a while and you like being mindful. It's kind of interesting. But then it doesn't seem to be going anywhere for you. So you kind of give up. I've told this story in here before, but I was, this has now been some years ago, I was with my teacher in India and I was riding a train back from Rishikesh, where he teaches, back to Delhi. And these Westerners, mostly U.S. people, got on the train. There was like 40 of them, or a lot of them, and they just sort of took over all the train. And they sat right in front of me, two of them. And then these people from other cars came that had been on the same retreat that they had been on. And I sat and listened to them as they got into a conversation about mindfulness. And this one guy said, well, you know, I tried that mindfulness practice for a few times. And it was interesting to see what my mind was doing like that. But then where did it go? Where did it lead? I'm sitting here going, let me tell you. And it would have been completely inappropriate. For what the circumstances did not come together that elicited enough interest, enough faith in the possibility for him to practice long enough to see how profound that mindfulness was, the many places that it did lead that were so wholesome, and what a really truly skillful means of not causing suffering to ourselves or another that mindfulness can be. There was not enough faith to get through the periods of where there was a plateau or there was difficulty around it. So we all need this faith. Faith is the seed. Some of the teachings say that the faith is in karma, that there's these four kinds of faith that I'm going to give you my version of this in a moment, but faith in karma, faith in the basic teachings of this is the nature of reality. Those basic teachings, such as that everything's always changing. That's a faith. You take confidence in that. That, yeah, things are always changing. And so forth. So, and then confidence in the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, that these are refuges, just as we took at the first of class. And this can take some period of time before you realize that this taking refuge in the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, what it means, why it is a refuge. But it's such a relief when you can let loose of your own personness, your own ego experience, and just be in Sangha here in the Dhamma. Just practicing. It's so spacious when we can get to that. So the faith in those three, and then confidence that the practices really do lead to liberation. I talk about faith in a couple of ways. One is that the faith that we are capable of knowing Dhamma, that what's true can be known, have enough faith that there's the possibility that something is, let me say this over again, faith that there is something to be known that leads to the end of suffering. To have that, just that it's a possibility, that's, you only need that much faith, that there's a possibility that there really is something to all of this. Just enough faith so we keep practicing, and then faith that there is a chance, there's a possibility that even I, with all of my limitations, can at least experience some significant amount of this understanding. Just a possibility in each instance. One doesn't have to have absolute knowing, so it's a start. One can spend years still checking it out with a lot of show me. But without some degree of faith, it can't go forward, because that faith generates the energy. And without the energy, we won't practice, we won't make it a priority. Faith is not a mental construct. Faith is a heart quality. So it's a feeling of the heart, this faith. Very strong in that way. But also, as we'll focus on in a moment, there can be a shadow side of faith. If there's too much faith, if faith is out of balance to the other faculties. The volitional aspect of faith, this act of choosing, I volitionally choose, I step up to the plate, my phrase that I ask myself, am I available to the Dhamma in this moment? I do this every day, over and over again, and have done for some number of years. Am I available right now to the Dhamma? I either am or I'm not. Oftentimes asking that question, suddenly I am available when I wasn't before, but not always. And I don't judge myself around that. But that is my expression of faith in that way. Am I available for these teachings to empower me to choose non-suffering over suffering? Suffering I'm causing myself, or causing others, or both. Or being available for others to cause me suffering. So if you're available to the Dhamma, it's much harder for others to cause you suffering. At least identified suffering, where you identify with the suffering. So there is this volitional aspect to it in which there is an act of resoluteness and of courage. And the courage is that we practice not knowing. Maybe this is all not true. Or maybe it's true, but I don't have the right circumstances that it's going to work for me. I don't know. Maybe I'd be better off just spending my time in front of the television and watching good channels where they're educational channels or something. You know? We don't know. I took a nice soft example, by the way, because I know nobody would choose really other things. I bring this up because we can lose the volition to practice and not notice it. Our practice kind of fades. We may come here on Sunday evening, but there's no practice during the week, or there's no mindfulness, just applied mindfulness in the course of our day, what we sometimes call walking around mindfulness. There's no sense of being available to the Dhamma in our daily lives. So there's this commitment, this you just choose. You're resolute. It's an act of will. You have enough faith of the possibility. So therefore, you're choosing as an act of will. Not coming out of a guarantee, if you see what I mean. But because this could be true, and you don't have a better way to practice. So this is, again, not your belief about, you know, the ontological beliefs and all of that. This is not the Buddhist system is not really ontological in my view in that way. And so so that's the volitional aspect of faith. The emotional aspect of faith is that there is a kind of clarity about, I really want my life to be about something. I don't want to be about all the gains and losses, the pain and pleasure. I don't want my whole life being measured by that. I don't want to be organized around that. That's going to happen on its own anyway, and it's always changing. One moment's pleasant, next moment's unpleasant. Then there's these endless moments of unpleasant and little respites of pleasant and all of this. It's just kind of a treadmill dreariness to this. I want my life to be about something larger, something that has more meaning than gain and loss, praise and blame, and so forth, the Buddha's eight worldly winds. So that's the emotional kind of commitment in this. In the commentaries, they will say that when you have faith, that you lose the five terrors. You can explore this for yourself. One is that you lose the terror about, I'm not going to have enough of the necessities of life. One is that you the loss of your reputation. The another one is around death. Another one is around a bad rebirth, and then another is around the impression you make on others. That you lose those. What do people think of me? Or am I good enough? And this, am I going to have enough? This fear of death. That as you have more and more faith, these things become less and less important. For most of us, not all at once, but a gradual fading away of our kind of core wanting elements in that way. Going along with faith as an act of will, a volitional act on our part, is that it does require a kind of self-discipline. That the faith is what gives us the self-discipline. And written about a lot and talked other times about renunciation, the importance of renunciation as an intentional practice, that that you choose in some way in your life that all the time you're working on some renunciation practice. Because without the ability to renounce, the ego's experience of having a reactive mind to what's pleasant and unpleasant, we get lost. So renunciation is the power to say no to that reactive mind. We don't necessarily stop it from reacting, but we don't go along with that reactive mind. Someone hurts our feelings, and then we start going into all this mind stream of one kind or another. The renunciationist goes, no, no, that hurt. My feelings are hurt, and I'm having reactive mind. And it stops there. Not perfectly stops. It comes back a number of times, but we don't feed it. We don't call up all of our friends and tell the story over and over again to feed it, right? We know that kind of feeding. So faith is one of the sources of renunciation. Last thing that I'll say about, well, two things I'll say. But there's a devotional aspect to faith. I'm spending more time on faith than the other ones tonight, by the way. There's a devotional aspect, and this is where it's finding that right balance of devotion. So at some point, I think almost everybody comes to love either the Buddha or the Dhamma or the Sangha. There has to be some degree of love. You know, it's just, have one of those three at least. It's just, the practice is repetitious, it's slow, it's difficult, and the love carries us through a lot. And so you might ask yourself right now, have you felt any love for one of these three? And it's love, it's a wholesome love. It's not a possessive love, but it's just like, so for me, where I started out was with loving the Dhamma. I loved the truth of the way things were, and that I could hear the truth of things were. And that was my first Dharma mats, or some word like that, with the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. I don't know, for you. That love makes us more generous with our time, and more willing to stay through the hard time. The shadow side of that, and where it can get out of balance, is people just love the idea of Dhamma, but they don't actually practice. So they just hang out in the love space. And that, when I first started teaching, there was a huge amount of that. I see less of that now. Although what I see now is that in relation to mindfulness, people now really love mindfulness, but they apply it so lightly because of secular mindfulness. They're missing the profound teachings, the deeper teachings around mindfulness. So they're hanging out in mindfulness, but at a very sort of practical level, and not liberation level. So that's another way that can happen. So then the other thing to say about faith is that one way that this is taught is that there is first inspired faith, where you hear the teachings and that really inspires you. So it's not your faith, you're inspired by someone else's faith. I sometimes call that borrowed faith. And this friend of mine who comes here sometimes, he first used that word in a way that I really liked, that I never thought of, when he said, you know, I'm just going to borrow some of your hope. Because it was a rough time for him. And so he was borrowing hope. And hope, by the way I've used hope, is hope that is possibility, that there is possibility. And when we're inspired by a teacher or by a reading, That is a kind of borrowed faith, not based on our own experience yet, but based on someone else's description. The most inspiring of all descriptions, of course, is the Buddha's own descriptions. And then the second kind of faith is what's called inspired, it's called a verified faith, where we start to have our own experience of faith, of the Dhamma. Go, oh, yeah, this really works. I really get this, at least this much of it. And that then, so that's knowing for ourselves. As the practice matures, it matures into absolute faith, where there's no doubt in certain things. And it's that level of faith that one experiences as part of this coming into Sotapanna, this sort of changing lineage. Okay, so that's faith. Energy, we've talked about so much. And energy, as I mentioned, can be looked at just in terms of the four right efforts. But it can also be looked at this this applying oneself, having the energy to persevere. One of the paramis is resoluteness, and of patience. These two attainments or perfections of the paramis. So that there's that energy. Energy takes that form of persevering and of just holding, being patient when things aren't going well, when you have to put yourself back together in your daily life or in your practice, or having your practice apply to your daily life, that you have the patience to let that all come back together and the perseverance together. And so that's not the traditional teachings like that, but I like to put it together that way for myself and for others. And so this, we can notice, do we have energy or not for practice? And we can have too little energy, but we can also have too much energy. And this is what I talk about when you come in for a one-to-one session with me on retreat. This is one of the things that I pay attention to. How much faith do you have in the practice? And how much energy do you have? Mindfulness, the third of these, is the sati, the mindfulness that you all know. That I'm not going to spend much time on that other than to remind you that mindfulness is the first of the seven factors of awakening. Mindfulness is also part of the Eightfold Path. Mindfulness is throughout the Buddha's teachings, the four foundations of mindfulness. It is mindfulness is, along with metta, what I would say are the two most important of the skillful means. And very important, this world of mindfulness. And it is deep. Mindfulness is deep. It's not just this superficial thing. It's really deep. It involves, because when mindfulness is really fully flowering, the five faculties are all present and the seven awakening factors are all present in some way. There's some connection to this wall, big things, and the Eightfold Path. They're all the samasati, the wise mindfulness of the Buddha. It's connected to all of these other key teachings. It's not like just being mindful if you're in a good mood or a bad mood. It's a whole deep, connected teaching. And then concentration, again, because you've heard so many talks on concentration, not that much to say about concentration. To me, concentration is the ability of the mind to be collected and unified around an object of our choosing, or concentrated and unified so that it's completely removed from the other sensory experiences. But so that the collecting and unifying the mind and momentarily, it's like you're just momentarily, you're present, then you lose it, then you're another. That's the mind's moving around like crazy, but you're able to kind of go with it, and you have, now you're aware of this, now you're aware of this, now you're aware of that. Momentary concentration. That concentration is enough to carry us forward. Neighborhood concentration, or this access concentration, is when the mind is so collected and unified that the hindrances of mind, restlessness and worry, sleepiness, wanting mind of desire, and aversion, and then the delusion. They're all at bay. The mind is protected. That's the level of concentration. It's excess concentration. That is something that all of us can experience to varying degrees. That's why we do a concentration retreat every year at Spirit Rock, is because with a steady practice in this way, almost everybody can achieve that. And then the absorption practices, the jhanas, are when the mind is completely isolated from the hindrances and from a lot of sensory input. And there's a great deal of debate about how isolated the mind has to be referred to being in jhana. And I don't find that discussion very useful, but I just mentioned that. So concentration applies in all of those ways. In this instance, in relation to the five spiritual faculties, it also refers simply to the calmness, so that that the mind is calm enough that you can practice, that you can think of it that way. It's not always used that way, but in this instance. And then the fifth, and there's wisdom, and in for those of you who like this kind of thing, in Samyutta Nikaya 48:51, the Buddha states that wisdom is the chief of the five faculties. That wisdom is the maturation of the five faculties in that way. And if the mind is too concentrated without enough energy, we fall asleep and we get drowsy. If the mind has too much energy and too much concentration but no mindfulness, it can go a bit crazy on us, too a lot crazy on us. So these are the ways that I use to see this. So I am interested, as the Buddha says, he's talking in the Nyutta Nikaya, he's talking to this one monk, and he says, so if you were playing your lute, would you not tune the strings? Da-da-da-da-da. And of course the monk says, yes. And the Buddha says, just so it is with our practice of the five faculties. We tune them. We balance them. We balance the way you balance the sound of the strings of the lute. It's the same, this importance of balancing these out. The traditional balances is that you have faith and wisdom balance each other out. That you don't want to have faith without wisdom, because there's no... What are you putting your faith in? It's just like some charismatic teacher, something you've heard or you saw a movie, and that's your faith. It's that it's said that faith is like a giant, and wisdom is small, but the difference between the two is that the faith is a giant with no eyes that is blind, whereas wisdom sees keenly. And so they each need the other. The strength of faith and this ability to have faith in what? To place one's faith in the appropriate ways. That's the wisdom factor, and that's how those two balance out. Then, in regards to the energy and the concentration, as I said, if you have too much energy and it's just all over the place, that doesn't work out. If you've got too little energy and too much concentration, you fall asleep. So there's a balancing of energy and concentration. And concentration, again, I so prefer this collected and unified mind. Your mind's together. Otherwise, your mind can go off and you can have a lot of energy but it's just running around everywhere. So you want that balance of the two. Likewise, without wisdom, If you have a lot of energy and you have a lot of concentration, but you have no wisdom, you can get concentrated in ways that are just making you miserable over and over again. So we need the mindfulness and the wisdom to recognize, I'm just playing the same old movie over and over again. I'm sitting here, sit after sit on this retreat, just running this same thing over and over again. This isn't going anywhere. I'm not really being mindful of it. The wisdom would recognize there's not really mindfulness here. I'm just indulging in this. I have gotten identified with it. It's taken me over. I've lost choice. I'm causing suffering. And so that's the role of the wisdom and the mindfulness together. And like I said earlier, energy needs the faith, because it's too hard sometimes without. You have to rely on faith. You're not getting reinforced in the moment of your practice. This is very true in a home practice. You sit down in the morning and you find yourself planning your day, and you feel guilty because you don't think you're meditating, or you find every excuse. I'm going to sit after my coffee. Oh, I just got to check this one thing, and so forth. You don't sit at all. You need the faith that gets you to sit, because the energy's going everywhere. Wisdom without the faith, without the heart quality, can lead to a very dry practice. So you can have mindfulness and you can have a pretty steady stream of mindfulness, but it's kind of like dust in an old man's cup, to steal a phrase. People just kind of lose interest in the practice, because I talk about it, my practice feels stale. That's one of the key phrases that are used. My practice feels stale. There's not enough faith, there's not enough love in it. So these are the five spiritual faculties and some amount of orientation about it. Again, the Buddha. By accomplishment and perfection in the five faculties, one is an arahant. If the faculties are weaker, one is a non-returner. If they're still weaker, one is a once-returner, or a stream winner, or a Dharma devotee, or a faith devotee. So there's a kind of progression through by this perfection of the five faculties. Thus, monks, through the difference of faculties, there's difference of result, and the difference of results makes the difference of individuals. I'll stop with that. So I wanted to take just a few moments for questions or comments about this, and I of any kind, but I'm particularly interested in personal experience, whether it's on retreat or in your home life, as you've heard this, anything that comes up about how you might practice or what. To really stay, I'm not so interested in the theory of it or, you know, the conceptual understanding, but like if you have trouble with one of these in terms of how to apply it, or you don't believe in it, or you don't get why they balance, but in terms of your own life, how you would use it, anything like that, that maybe, yes, please.
This is a little bit
You know, I'm going to have to use the mic here because it's going to... Sorry, just wait a moment. And hold it up like an ice cream cone.
Yeah. That's good. Is this better?
Yes.
Okay. So... my experience right now in listening to you probably was informed by the body movement that we had that you led us in, because the direct experience, it got beyond words for me, and it was embodied. And the embodied experience was my body, that I experienced experience it as mindfulness at the core of the body, and then imagining the two arms going up in either direction. And you're spinning this around. So the right practice on this side, if my practice, if my right actions are moving me in the right place, it sort of leads me to have faith. As I was experiencing it, it sort of puts me in a position where I can get faith. And the same on the other side, that if I'm having, if my concentration is sort of moving in the right way, then it sort of puts me in a place where I can start really experiencing the wisdom that you were describing. And, you know, without belaboring it too much, then I can also experience the faith and the wisdom coming together out here, providing this whole kind of holding experience. So I'm putting it into words now that feels kind of dry, but you were just sort of, your words were just sort of washing over me in that direct
experience. Right.
And I'm very grateful because it's the first time that it's sort of come together in that kind of grounded way.
Yeah, you said that very well in terms of the that the this embodiment. I always start, not always, but almost always start these meditations with body awareness because I feel as though it is an embodied mindfulness. It is it that that is the way we find this direct experience. And so there's a felt experience, a direct experience of each of these five faculties. And when you felt it in the, when you were, the movement for you brought you into direct awareness of experience, and then you could open to that same direct experience of faith or wisdom in this way. And that is how, when we're fortunate enough, it works that way. That if we, once we get in, we're inside it, and then we're having it, we're having the direct experience of things, even if it's a fairly superficial direct experience rather than just the coconut. And then you saw the difference when you tried to describe it, how easily it, it moved away from the embodied awareness and can move up. And so when I am offering, you know, what insights I have to offer, I am consciously staying in my body, having this direct experience. Faith has a feeling. That's an embodied feeling. The feeling of faith is embodied. The feeling of energy is easily embodied. I mean, that's one of the easiest ones to find. But mindfulness is an embodied experience. The mindfulness is here and now. I use those phrases all sorts of different ways because it really is that way. I mean, this is the way it is, as I would understand the Buddha's teachings, the here and now, the ah of it. It's felt, it's direct. And on with concentration as a felt experience, and wisdom not as a removed wisdom, but as a lived wisdom that does include the heart. So it's that because ultimately it's the heart that gets liberated, and it, the mind becomes wise in such a way that this access to the heart and the freeing of the heart is there. So someone else, let's go over here, and then we'll come up.
Yeah, you spoke about when you're wanting to meditate, say in the morning, and then you find yourself doing something else.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned that it had to do with faith or lack of, I suppose, at that moment. How would you then cultivate that faith, or how would faith come into play to help you to make your practice more?
Well, so her question is, how does faith come in into when we're trying to get ourselves to practice in the morning and we don't? In a more full answer, all five of them come into play. We're mindful of, oh, here I am, the artful dodger. Here's the mind playing its tricks on me. Here you are, Mara, distracting me with coffee, with the internet, with whatever it may be, checking my email. Crazy to get up in the morning and check our emails. But we do it, I guess. So, so we that with the mindfulness sees what we're doing, and then the mindfulness empowers us to remember our commitment. Our faith is our commitment. We're committed to this. We're putting our faith. We're betting our chips. If you want to go to the casino, we're betting our chips on practice rather than on maximizing pleasure. That's the choice we're making. So if that's the choice we're making, then let's line up, because let's line up with how we've bet our chips, you know. That's a kind of remembering of the mindfulness and the faith together. And then the faith is the with the mindfulness. You remember how good it feels when you feel aligned. And then the as you're remembering all of this with the faith feeling of it, then you have the energy to make it the you know, I talk about renunciation and it's part of faith. Then you have the energy to sit and practice, even enough energy to overcome this distracted mind, and then it gradually gets collected and unified enough to practice. And then the faith also allows you to accept whatever you get in any particular morning or any weeks in a row of sits that don't feel very satisfactory. You know, that so it works like that, if that's helpful to you. One more. Let's take this gentleman here, right in front.
It's a similar sort of question, I guess, around encouraging faith, and I guess I paraphrase you maybe as constructive volition.
That's a fine phrase.
In such a way that it doesn't, what I find it is inhibits me is that very quickly it can become sort of a war with myself around not good enough.
Yes.
And I'm very tightly focused on that.
Right, yes. No wisdom in that.
Yeah. But knowing that intellectually doesn't necessarily break that cycle for me.
So, and there's a whole other teachings about all of that that would be, I can't even begin to get into them tonight. But when the mind is focused and concentrated on what you're doing, temporarily all that other stuff is at bay. If you're able to go ahead and practice, you're able to concentrate, then it's temporarily at bay. That judging mind, the comparing mind, and that terrible influence of the shoulds. You know, the worst kind of flu is this epidemic of the shoulds that we have in the Dharma. And the shoulds are not very useful. They just aren't. They don't. And we all know that's true. We can easily prove it to ourselves, because you'll have two or three thoughts before the night's up about you should do something and see that you don't do it. Or you should not, right? I should not open that refrigerator door opening. I should go to bed now. Let's see what the ball scores were, you know, whatever it may be. So that the mindfulness and the wisdom together say, that's not a successful strategy for finding well-being in life. In a very practical way, this is what I mean. It's not belief. There's no big belief structure. You just see for yourself. That doesn't really bring well-being. And if you want a sense of meaning, a sense of well-being, a sense of calm, a sense of not harming yourself or others, then that becomes your articles of faith. This is why you're doing this. And it's then the heart opens to it feels, when my heart is not constricted by the shoulds or by my guilt over something I have done, or my feeling like, oh, I've missed this or I missed that in my life, the heart is naturally free of all of those. It's the ego's interpretation puts so much of the heaviness and constriction in the heart space through the mind. You know, the mind gets constricted, and the heart gets heavy. And I can stay heavy or stay constricted, however you want to state it. So this coming back to exploring each of these one at a time, I would have you know all five of them over time, but if you really want to practice one at a time for at least some weeks. For myself, I do things in a minimum of 3 months at a time, because that's sort of the minimum for me to really deeply know something. So if I'm going to know faith, I think about it, I practice it, I'll go, what's faith like today? What is faith today? Because, you know, it'll switch around what I mean by faith to me, You know, and so I'm really interested in faith for 3 months, and then I switch to another one. I don't so much use these, but I'm since this is what I'm presenting tonight, I'm talking about the way to do this, so that there's some deep familiarity, if that's a word. I wouldn't even mastery is too far in the distance. But deep familiarity, we can all have deep familiarity, right? I mean, no matter how much we are failing in it, we get more and more familiar with it. As long as we don't quit on ourselves. There's a certain degree of faith right there, right? Is that true or not? You know, I don't know. He says it's true that if I keep doing something, I'll become more familiar with it. Is that true or not? So you go test it for yourself, and then you go, oh, that is true. I'm getting more familiar with this. I don't feel like I'm mastering it. I don't feel like I'm actually making any progress, but I sure know myself in relation to this better. That's verified faith. So that's how it works. It's the Buddha Dhamma is so direct, so accessible in that way. Because we don't have to hold a lot of constructs. We do have to have enough of the structure to like organize our minds. And you can take any teaching and organize your mind around that teaching for a year or whatever period of time. And then you add another and another. And it just keeps on unfolding. Have to stop with that. But I hope this was of some use in this way. And happy to answer questions individually and so forth. Now I'm going to ask us to close our eyes.